Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting worldwide on Internet Radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to today's show. My name is Mark Kohler, and I'm with my amazing co-host, Matt Sorensen. And gosh, sorry about that. You know, it's a little loud coming in. I get it. You know, some of you that were turning to the podcast goes, geez, turn on the volume, guys. What's going on? Sorry about that, Matt.
Hey, you know, we're loud and proud.
Loud and proud. And you know, hey, we're running our own studio now back at Blog Talk Radio, freaking loving it. And you know what? We were in the AM studio for the last 6 months. It was driving us crazy. It was nuts. So, yeah, you get the AM guy running the, you know, the booth and all that crap. But, geez, who listens to AM anymore? I don't know. I'm probably offending someone out there. Yeah. Who does?
Well, you know, that's what a good podcast does, you know. People come back, they, you know, it's the shock jock. Actually, AM radio paved the way to offend people, and they want to just listen to it.
Yeah. Well, and we kind of have a Howard Stern approach. We want to say what we want to say. This is a rated PG-13 show. And can you take taxes and legal to a PG-13 level? I don't know. But anyway, we're trying. But no,
yeah,
thank you everybody for listening. Yeah.
It's PG-13 for horror and violence. That's the tax and legal side of things in our lives, unfortunately.
Yeah, speaking of that, and first, let me say, welcome to all of you that are new listeners. We're here every Wednesday live on Blog Talk Radio. If you get our newsletter each week, there's a link so you can listen on your computer if you're grabbing lunch at that time. It's noon Mountain Time, so do the math. But you can also call in from your phone. So if you're sitting in a parking lot eating your Wendy's double, you know, baconator, you know, you can listen in while you're on your phone. But this is our live call-in show this week. People love this. Matt, I mean, you've gotten emails all week. It's like, gosh, questions
from our
listeners around the country.
We got questions. And, you know, people have questions, and we've got answers. And that's what the people demand. That's what we're going to bring to you. And that's what the show today is going to be about. If you do have questions, though, I know, Mark, you're on the Facebook right now,
yeah.
Trolling for people to have live questions on Facebook.
Yeah, so you can get a hold of us different ways. You can email mark@kkoslawyers.com, Matt@kkoslawyers.com. I'm on Facebook right now on my fan page, a couple posts announcing the show today, so you can comment right there in the post, and there's a couple questions in there already. We tweeted it out. You could send us a tweet. And if you want, you get priority with your question. If you call in live, we would love to hear your voice. So we take live callers priority. And the phone number to call in live today is 646-668-8326. 646-668-8326. And please, as you follow our show, every third to fourth podcast is a call-in show. And if you're getting the newsletter, you'll get the announcement. So in the future, you can maybe plan your agenda so you're here with us live and asking some questions on the show.
All right. Well,
now,
Mark,
Matt,
sure you've been...
Oh.
I know you're a big fan of Purple Rain.
I was just going to bring this up, Matt. I love it.
All right. Because, you know, Prince passed away last week. And for many Prince fans out there, I just, you know, condolences to you. But the latest news is there's still no will. But apparently there's – I haven't heard the latest, but they're still searching for a will in the estate for Prince. This is kind of a crazy story. We're rolling into our estate planning month, everyone, which we'll be laying out later this month, and we'll be doing some shows about estate planning and the importance of it. But this has just been in the news this last week. The beloved singer-songwriter Prince, or the artist formerly known as Prince, or I don't know what he's who he is anymore or was, but there's still no will, but the search continues.
Yeah, and you know, I did hear too. This is really a sad story, and we're going to be doing an estate planning radio show in the next few weeks, and we'll have more information on the Prince saga. But already, there's talk of a half brother that Prince was estranged with, who's going to be inheriting millions, and he hasn't even talked with Prince in 20, 30 years. Now that's the rumor mill. We'll get to the bottom of it. Very similar to the Jimi Hendrix story that we've talked about previously, where his father, who he was estranged with for years, ended up inheriting his entire music portfolio, or you know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I'm sure none of our listeners would be in this predicament. I'm sure all of you listening today have your will and trust in the estate plan because we know and we teach it here, you will live forever. So you don't need to worry about this.
Right.
Just, there's no stress. So, oh, folks, good stuff. All right. Well, this is our call. Yeah, Matt, any final words on that, Matt? I didn't mean to go too far on it.
No, yeah, we'll talk more about Prince. I just I want to pique the interest of everybody, and I know, you know, I've had friends of mine, you know, generally not interested at all in estate planning, asking questions about this because of Prince. So I'm glad that, you know, some of these examples, though tragic, can help us think about something for ourselves to make sure we don't get in a similar situation. But I wanted to talk about the question of the week that I posed from last week, and we had a winner, and I wanted to run over that before we jump into all the other questions we got. As everyone knows, we do a question of the week every week. It's an opportunity to win a free copy of either mine or Mark's book. The winner smartly chose my book. And so let me run over the question from last week and announce the winner. All right.
I like
the question.
It. Go for it.
All right. The question from last week was, where can you contribute more money into, a SEP IRA or a solo 401k for a self-employed person with $100,000 of self-employment income? Now, this is a point we want to just make sure everybody's aware of, because there is a huge perk to using a solo 401k. And Cynthia wrote in from Memphis with the correct answer, which was you can contribute more to a solo 401k than a SEP IRA with $100,000 of self-employment income. And let me go over why that's the case. A lot of people will use a SEP IRA because it's really easy to set up. If you're self-employed, you know, and you want to put more than $5,500 into an IRA, you may have been using a SEP IRA. And the reason for that is you can put 25% of your compensation into a SEP IRA for those who are self-employed. That's a great little perk and benefit. That's a heck of a lot more than $5,500. So for example, someone with $100,000 of income could put in potentially $25,000 into a SEP IRA. That's kind of nice, but if you look at someone who has $100,000 of self-employment income who could use a solo 401k, I get to do $18,000, as long as I made $18,000, plus 25% of my compensation, which would be $25,000. So I'm able to do $18,000 plus the $25,000, or in this case $43,000, off of that same $100,000 of self-employment income. So the solo 401k gives you much more bang for your buck for those looking to maximize contributions, build up more money in their retirement account. And if you're self-employed, the solo 401k is going to be a great fit. You'll get far more into that over time than you would with a SEP IRA.
Yeah. Now, if you allow me, Matt, let me kind of just add another example to this. Now, I'm up in Idaho right now, and I'm going to be running in a race on June 6th. Now, some of you may from Idaho know that this race because it's quite famous, and they have all sorts of levels. I don't want to allude to the fact I might be running a marathon. That's not me. I'll be at the 5K looking for the pancake breakfast after. It's a very important point. Okay. Now, in Idaho, about 30, 40 years ago, there was a dam that broke, and the dam flooded all of eastern Idaho. It was a disaster. It was just a complete, you know, federal disaster issue. This dam broke. So every year, they commemorate this event, this terrible tragedy, with a dam race. They have a race around the dam. So this dam race is a lot of fun because there's dam officials. You get a dam shirt. My kids have carte blanche, Matt, to swear all weekend. You know, hey, Dad, when are we going to get this dam race? This is their chance, you know, to swear all weekend.
And you can say, shut up with your damn questions.
That's right. I like that. I'll use that. So, and I'm hoping to get a damn medal, and I'm going to have damn pancakes after. So it's going to be sweet. Now, okay, so you can see I'm going to milk this for all it's worth. But here's the cool part. Here's why this relates to Matt's question of the week, is that when you want to put money into a retirement plan and you own a small business and you're doing your S-corp salary strategy, which we love, when you get to the damn race, they let the 401k owners have an 18,000 foot head start while the SEP people have to wait on the starting line where everybody else is. See, in the world of retirement contributions, you get an $18,000 head start with the 401k, then 25% of your comp, which in the S-corp strategy, you're going to be paying less self-employment tax with. So folks, it is just like so cool, the efficiency of the 401k, because you would get that 18,000 foot damn race head start. There you go. Just a little analogy.
Yeah. And we've been helping a lot of clients, you know, set up solo 401ks, and we had many clients who have been in SEP IRAs transition over to the solo 401k just because they can get more in year to year on contributions on less income. And as Mark's, you know, as Mark was alluding there, I love that, is because there's always this incentive to keep your salary low, and that's what you contribute off of is your salary, and you're going to get much more bang for your buck out of the solo 401k. So Cynthia, she already picked my book, sorry to say, but Cynthia, I'll be happy to send that out to you. We'll just get your address and send out a free copy of the book.
I love it. Okay, and now later in the show, I will pose the question for this week so that those that are quickly on their smartphone, they can answer quickly and win a copy of my book and make a much wiser decision. If they win this week. Okay. Now, this week we had a request. We listened to our listeners as well, and we had some feedback this last month, and they said, Mark and Matt, don't do your tax and legal tips during your open forum show. You've got so many questions to cover. Just jump right into it. And Matt and I said, you know what? That's a great comment. So, Matt, are you ready? You got your arms and hands in? You ready to do it?
Yeah, I'm buckled up, ready to go.
Okay, well, I'm going to throw it out to you, my amazing co-host. You've got questions already emailed to you. Well, you go ahead. You choose the first question. We're going to start rapid firing, folks. We're going to go through these quick because we've got a lot to cover.
Okay, I'm going to throw this one to you, all right? This is from Matt. This is not me. This is Matt from Michigan. Wrote in, my dog grooming business has changed from a sole prop to an LLC. I'd like to be taxed as an S-Corp for 2016, but the entity was created after the March 15th deadline. Can I be taxed as an S-Corp for the months that I was an LLC, or must I wait for 2017 tax year?
No, we can backdate your S-Corp to the beginning of 2016 grab the entire year. So we don't want to and Matt, we've got a live caller, and I was kind of multitasking here. Tell me the timing. When did they set up the LLC?
Well, he said it wasn't clear, but he says my dog grooming business changed from – this is a dog grooming business from a sole prop to an LLC. And he said he wants to be taxed as an S-Corp for 2016, but it says the entity was created after the March 15th deadline. So presumably between now in March 15th of this year, he set up the actual LLC. But he wants it to be taxed as an S-Corp.
Yeah, good comment. Okay, so here's the thing. Let's assume that any of you listening right now have an LLC and you're doing your business, and it should have been an S-Corp for 2016. The old rule back in the day, and it's still on the books, but there's a get-out-of-jail-free card. The old rule was you had to make this S-election by March 15th to get it back to January 1st. But there's a new RevProc that if you write that RevProc ruling at the top of your S-election, you can do it any time this year. So Matt, Dog Grooming Business Matt, Matt Sorensen. So our call.
Matt from Michigan.
Got to get this straight. That's right. Matt from Michigan. Just get in touch with our paralegal team, Susan. She can help with the S election. We charge $100. We can backdate it with the proper designation at the top. And if you have the LLC for the entire year, we can backdate it to the first of the year. If you set up the LLC after January 1st, then we would be able to backdate it to the beginning of your LLC. But your business will be an S-Corp for 2016. That's the goal. That's the strategy. We've got radio shows dedicated to that topic, all sorts of videos and articles. So keep your study on that and set up a consult. Can help you with that.
Yep.
Love
so
it.
I think for Matt, he's going to have partial year as a sole prop at the beginning of the year. But from once he set up the LLC, he'll be able to get the S-Corp tax treatment for the full rest of the year.
Yeah. There's a couple variations there because, Matt, we don't know the exact timing. Okay, now we've got a live caller, and they always get priority, so I'm excited. This is Lisa with a question online. Lisa, you're on live with the Refresh Your Wealth show.
How are you? I'm so excited. I tune in every week and have been catching up on all the shows. I just love it. I had a chance to meet you in January, Mark, up in Chicago at the Renata's class.
Ah, thanks. Hey, and thanks for being a regular listener. I love it. We love the live caller. And this, you know, this is pretty famous opportunity of you to be here live with us, you know. We're glad to have you here.
I know. And I wanted to make sure I call in so I can have my moment in fame with you. So so my question is, on one of the shows not too long ago, you talked about the infinite banking. And my question is, has it been used to fund projects? And if so, what is the best structure?
Okay. Matt, boy, thanks, Lisa. Okay, sorry for breaking up. We didn't get that. Yeah, we're going to have to have you on another day.
Okay, what about now? Is that better?
I was joking.
You did
this is a hard question. Yeah, this is a hard question. Okay, Matt. You want me to take a stab at it, or are you an infinite banking whiz? I'll let you go first.
Yeah, I'm happy to go first and say I have no idea.
Okay. All right. And this is your next answer that's a little better than that, but it's not going to be good. So here's the deal. Infinite banking, and I'll be honest with you, we actually, Lisa, have not held a show on infinite banking. I think we had a guest a few months ago that brought it up. Randy Lubke. He maybe just alluded to it, and we really didn't dive into it deeply. And maybe note to self, Matt, we ought to talk about doing a show on infinite banking. And I would probably – here's what I would say. I would probably title the show The Pros and Cons of Infinite Banking. So here's what it is. If, for those that are thinking, what the crap are they talking about? Infinite banking is where you use a life insurance platform to build some cash flow in your – life insurance to fund your business and avoid taxes and try to build wealth within this life insurance structure. Is that a fair summary, Lisa?
Fair. I'll give you a fair.
Now, yeah, fair. And here's the problem that I have, and I'm going to probably offend some of our regular listeners, but you're going to get to know me on this, is that whenever you're using cash value life insurance to fund your business or fund your retirement, I'm not opposed to that, but I'm opposed to it for the average brand new or up-and-coming business owner. I tend to use the life insurance and infinite banking for my clients that have a really strong financial structure already. They've got regular cash flow. They could very well be out of debt. And if there's a problem in making, there wouldn't be a problem in making their premiums because they're so financially strong. And then we get into cash value insurance strategies. And I know that some of you out there that are insurance agents will agree with me that cash value, whole life, universal life, VUL, whatever you want to call it, gets oversold a lot of times to people that aren't ready for that in their lives and their investment portfolio. But they get sold it anyway. And that's what ticks me off. So infinite banking is in that discussion, and I think infinite banking gets oversold to people that just need a freaking normal business initially, and then once they get more wealthy, they can go into something like that. So that's my initial reaction, and yes, I see people fund businesses with it. Yes, I see them fund their own business with infinite banking, but they've got to be careful that it's the right fit for them. So that's my take.
Okay. All right. Can I have, I have one more question.
What do you think? Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So the next question is, I established a LLC in 2009. Haven't paid any taxes.
Okay.
Haven't really done any business. Just kind of been, you know, I knew I needed to have it in place, and I have a project that I'm working on. And so now, since I've been listening to the Refresh Your Wealth show, I need to have it as an S-Corp selection because we're going to have employees with the project, and it's a huge, wonderful project that's going to serve the earth, and so we're going to have to hire people. So I'm looking at the 8832 form, and I'm like, okay, it looks so Greek to me. So how do I fill out that form? You know, is it a address change, a late classification? You know, relief of late change, because as I read the instructions, it was like, I was like, well, it's set up in 2009, but we haven't really done anything with it. So what do I check, you know, as to that which applies?
You bet. Lisa, great comment. And let me answer this off the air for you and say thank you for calling in. We love that you're listening, and please continue to listen. This is great. all right. Thank you. Okay. So Lisa's question is great, and it relates to the first question from Matt from Michigan. So, Lisa, the deal is you're not going to mess around with Form 8832. You're going to go to 2553. 2553 is the S-election form, the same one that Matt from Michigan is going to use. And you, since you're kind of in the middle of the year almost, we're in May now, you're going to want to make sure that it has the right RevProc designation number at the top of the form so you can backdate it to the first of the year, which will make life easier. Assuming that that's what you should be doing, but having the S-Corp for the whole year, that's a whole other question. But if you know you need the S-Corp, you're going to use Form 2553. You can do it yourself. It's something that can get screwed up, so be careful. We charge $100, very affordable. Call Susan at our office if you need it done, and maybe even get your partners on the line and do a 20 or 30 minute consult regarding the project and what the plans are, because it may be best to keep it as an LLC and make sure the individual partners are S-Corps. So we might even take the LLC and change the ownership structure to integrate S-Corps at the second level. And a lot of times that can be better than making an S-election at the top. So don't rush into the 2553. I would truly pay for a 20-minute consult with an attorney, a tax-type attorney, and all the attorneys in our office could certainly field this. So set some time up. All right, there we go. Matt, you're up. Man, I've been talking way too much.
All right, well, I got another question here. Okay, this is from Michael. Michael wrote in with a question to both of us. Say, I'm a longtime listener of your podcast, incorporated listening to your podcast into my jogging routine, so I exercise my mind as well as my body. Thanks for all the excellent advice and ideas. Here's a question. He says, I want to know how the IRS will consider my business transactions as investing and not running a business. My business, I provide hard money loans or private loans to companies needing short-term cash for real estate transactions. Most of the times, I originate the loan, underwrite it, and service the loan myself, and I use an S-Corp for this. However, he has having trouble finding many new loans, so he wants to work with other organizations that do this for him. The other company would find the borrowers, qualify them, and another company they work with services the monthly payments. And in the end, it sounds like he's just going to be providing the money. If I work with this other company and become the lender for the loans they originate, will the IRS consider this investing and not running a business. You want to pause there? I can give my thoughts first, Mark, initially, if you'd like.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I've already been dominating too much of the show, so go for it. I'll follow your lead.
Whenever it starts IRS, I usually defer to Mark. But now, in this, I think what he's referring to is obviously he's using an S corporation and receiving this income, which he's doing lending activities. This is kind of a tricky question because you're going to have different types of income you're going to get from lending. Now, generally, when you're lending out money to others, the interest and points you receive from the lending activity is considered interest income. And this is what we're calling just, you know, this is just him individually, his own personal money. We're not talking about an IRA here. I don't want to confuse that. This is him, is your individually loaning money. Now, since he's doing multiple loans and he's underwriting many loans at a time, sounds like he's already been considering this as business income as opposed to interest or investment income, and therefore he's running it through an S corporation. His question now is, I want to run this income through, have someone else basically do all the work, and I'm just passively loaning the money now. And am I still going to be able to run this through my S corporation and call it business income? I want to just take a minute here to kind of separate. You may actually want the opposite treatment. Also, let me say that first. The question is kind of alluding to the fact that you want to run this through your S corporation, and you want this to be business income. And there maybe you're contributing to your 401k from this, or there may be reasons you're wanting to do that. And I think whether you're lending it out to others and someone else is servicing it, I mean, you're probably going to be okay running it through your S corporation still. But you may want to just call it interest income and keep it outside of the S corporation, particularly if you're not involved much in the lending activities, because interest income is automatically exempt from self-employment tax. So you may not want that income going through the S corporation. You may want it just coming to you personally, either through an LLC or just through your personal tax return as interest income, therefore exempt from Medicare, Social Security tax anyways, because it's interest income. What do you think about that, Mark?
I love it. And I'm going to take a different approach to his question. I'm going to say, hey, Michael, I think I'm going to say Michael wants it to be interest income and get it out of the S corp. And I would say the IRS would classify it as passive income if you're not the one originating and servicing the loan. So there it is, kind of simply stated, if you're just the lender, passive. If you're the one originating it and servicing it and it's your primary occupation, you better run it through the S corp. So I think you're going to be good, Michael, moving to that other platform where you're just the investor, and I think you'll be okay. All right, let me fill the healthcare strategy question. And for those that have called in, let me just say, for those that are on the line calling in, if you press the number one, you can our studio producer, Jennifer, will pick up the line and see if you would like to come live on the show. She'll get you lined up. So for those that are calling in, the number is 646-668-8326. And again, if you want to email a question, we're taking them live here, mark at kkoslawyers and Matt, M-A-T, at kkoslawyers. We've got some questions here on Facebook, too. So we're going to move quick. Now, Dolph says, Mark, in a husband and wife only S-Corp, health insurance premiums are a corporate deduction. How about actual expenses beyond the premiums? Well, such as copays and medicine. Love your question, Adolf. And this is, he goes by Dolph, or in the full name, Adolf. This is huge. This is a really good question. First, let me just say, believe it or not, you're going to pay for those health insurance premiums through your S-Corp, and you're supposed to pay for those health insurance premiums with your S-Corp. That's how it's supposed to happen, but technically it's still a personal deduction on the front page of your tax return, but paying for it through the S-Corp allows you to do it. So a little technical point there. Keep doing what you're doing. Let the S-Corp pay the premiums, but it's really not a corporate deduction. It just flows through onto the front page of your return, which is still cool. Next. How about all those actual expenses? Oh my gosh, Dolph, this is huge because I write a lot and I've spoken a lot about the HSA, health savings account, or the HRA, health reimbursement arrangement. Bottom line, for any of you listening today, If you want to write off the copays, the deductible, the dental, the eyes, the chiropractic, the massages, whatever it is to help you with your health outside of your health insurance, you've either got to do an HSA, health savings account, or an HRA, a reimbursement arrangement. I diagram how to do both of these in my book, my newest book, Tax and Legal Playbook, which if you answer our question coming up here shortly correctly, you can win a copy of that. We've done an entire radio show on some of these strategies, Adolf, and also I've got videos online on my website and articles. So study up on that. Everybody else out there, don't think that you're going to be able to itemize and get the bang for your buck. Trying to itemize your medical expenses is a joke. Under Obamacare now, it's limited to 10%, anything above 10% of your AGI. So you're getting nothing. So think HSA, think HRA, although Adolf, and keep studying. You're going to love it. Okay, Matt, this question's for you, so let me pose it to you. This is from Bruce,
okay.
And he says, hey, love you. He doesn't say anything. Sorry. He says, hi. He says, is there any way – I was going to ham it up a little bit more for you, Bruce. Anyway, he says, is there any way that I can use my IRA funds to pay off a rental mortgage, so a mortgage on my rental property, or use my IRA to pay off my home mortgage? Matt, please tell me it's true. Can we do it? I would love it.
Oh, I'm going to be breaking hearts here. There's no way to use the IRA, but I've got a Hail Mary pass you can maybe throw, and maybe it's not even a Hail Mary. Maybe it's just like 3rd and 20. You know, it's possible. It might work, but we'll see. Okay. If you're self-employed, see the IRA, you're prohibited to the IRA. You can't use your money in your IRA to loan yourself money or anything like that or pay for your personal expenses. That's one of the rules of self-directed IRAs. But there is one option. If you're self-employed, you could set up a solo 401k. This is one of the other perks of solo 401ks. I talked about this earlier in my tip. You could set up a solo 401k, roll over the IRA money to the solo 401k, and then you can take a 401k loan. See, 401ks have one little – well, there's a number of differences, but they have one difference here in terms of getting money out of it personally. In a 401k, you can take half the balance of your 401k, not to exceed 50 grand, and use it personally. So if you had $100,000 in that IRA, for example, and you're self-employed, we could go set up a solo 401k. You can roll that IRA over to the solo 401k and then take a loan out for half the balance of the 401k, not to exceed 50 grand. So if you had 100 grand in there, we'd be able to get out 50 grand, which is the max. And you can use that 50,000 for any personal expense you want. You could go to Vegas. You could pay off high-interest debt, whatever you want to do, start up a new business. Personally, any of that stuff you can use that 50K for. You've just got to pay the 401K back, which is fine. You're paying back your own 401K. You get to pay it prime plus interest, which is 2%, or sorry, which is 3.25 plus 2%, so it's about 5% interest, and it goes back into your own 401K. You have to pay it back over 5 years. So if you're self-employed, you might be able to do this 401K loan structure to get up to 50,000 out. That's your only play, though. I don't have any other options for you.
I like it. I was going to say the same thing. So it's a great question, Bruce. Pay mortgage to yourself through the 401k loan rather than pay a mortgage to Wells Fargo. But you can only do it up to 50 grand. Another way of saying it. Okay, now we got another live caller.
All right, Mark, I got another question. Oh, go ahead. All right.
Oh, hey, live caller.
Flying in now.
Back off.
Yeah, all right.
Back off, dude. Yeah, okay, live caller.
Easy enough.
Got to give him some. There you go. All right. Well, we've got JC on the line, and JC, welcome to Refresh Your Wealth. What's going on?
Well, thank you. My question for you guys is, what cost basis on a stock would I use? Would I use the original stock price that my grandfather purchased it at and I have now inherited, or do I use the cost basis on this current year because the stock was bought 30, 40 years ago? And we're in the process of selling some of that. So I need to know which cost basis I use.
I love it. Matt, can I field it? Is that all right?
Yeah, because this is a good answer.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the first answer is neither. Tomato, tomato.
Neither.
You're not going to take what he paid for the stock, and you're not going to take what the current value is either this year. You're going to take the value at his date of death. So based on the death certificate per se, look at the date of death, and I'm sure you know the day your grandpa died. Sorry, that was probably I would look at your date. I'd look at the death certificate. But anyway, yeah, so you take the date of death, and then you go back into the history of that stock. Usually your stockbroker can do this for you. There's websites and all that good stuff. And you go to the date of that date of death, and boom, that's your value. So you would either get a write-off for any reduction in value since that date, or you'd only pay tax on the appreciated gains since that date.
Okay.
And there you go.
Thank you.
Did he die in the few years? Thank you. Has he died recently or several years ago? Or?
Four years ago.
Ooh, okay. Hey, that's good news because the stock market lately has been great, you know, which is always a wild card, but... So, anyway, that's good stuff. Well,
great. Thank you, guys. Have a wonderful day.
Hey, thank you, JC. Hey, thanks for listening. Call in anytime. Love it.
Absolutely. Come on down to San Diego. We'd love to have you down here a little more.
Woo. We'd love to be down there a little more. That's easy.
Okay. Bye.
Love it.
That's where I go. Summer in Phoenix. I'm getting out of here. I'm going to San Diego.
Yeah, that's the place to go. I know.
All right,
you're
well,
still
I got another question
decent
here.
Weather. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
go
yeah.
ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, it's awesome here. It is awesome here. In a couple months, though, we're gonna be hurting here in Phoenix. So, all right, I got a emailed question in from Craig from Aurora, Colorado. He wrote in. He says, "I'm selling a rental property in an LLC with a partner. I want to buy something else and do a 1031 exchange, but she doesn't. I presume this is a partner. Is there any option for us to sell the property and allow me to do a 1031 exchange?"
Ooh, good stuff.
I'll take first swing at this if you like.
I love it. Go for it, dude.
All right. So now here's the first principle in a 1031 exchange, and just so everybody knows, a 1031 exchange is a way you can sell a property and repurchase a new property. There are certain timing rules. You have to identify a property and then close on that property within 180 days. But essentially allows you to defer the gain over into the next property so you don't pay taxes when you sell the property. And then you own the new property. And then when you sell that property, you could do another 1031 exchange or pay the taxes due when you sell the replacement property. So the 1031 exchange is cool because it allows you to sell a property where you have a profit but roll it into the next property as long as you buy something of equal or greater value. Now, the problem he's got in his situation is it's an LLC selling the property. He wants to buy something else. His partner doesn't. And one of the rules of a 1031 exchange is the party selling the property, in this example the LLC, must be the same party that repurchases the property. And if the partner doesn't want to buy a new property, that may cause some issues. Now, there's a couple options here to consider and probably want to get a consult on this because there's a little more detail to this, but let me throw out two options. You want to do this, obviously, before you sell. Option one, buy the partner out of the LLC. You may be able to just buy the partner out of the LLC, then have the LLC sell the property. You own the LLC 100%, and then use that same LLC to repurchase a new property. That would be option number one. Option number two is you may do what's called a tenant in common deed the property out of the LLC to you and your partner individually as tenants in common. And maybe you're, I don't know if you're 50-50 or whatever you are, you know, you might have a 50% tenant in common interest in the deed. Partner gets a 50% tenant in common interest in the deed. And then when you sell the property, you'll take your interest and roll it to a new property. Partner cashes out at closing and gets separate proceeds because they have a separate property interest. So those would be two options of what you could do. I would definitely get a consult on those, but those are two things to look at to allow you to 1031 and let your partner essentially cash out.
Gosh, I couldn't say it any better. Matt, well done. If anybody says you don't know 1031s, then they're full of crap. That was great. All right, we're going to jump over to Facebook now. So we got some Facebook questions. I'm going to take the first one that came in. This is from Eris, and he says, how do I make my 14-year-old a tax-deductible employee? Eris, love it. Okay, you're speaking my language, because I know any 14-year-old in your life is not an asset. They are a liability in more ways than one. And I love my children. I'm just saying. Okay. Now, so here's the trick. Eris, big topic. Again, I have a whole chapter in my new book on this. We have dedicated prior radio shows and podcasts to this. So please get back into your iTunes history there and look for Paying Family Members. And again, there's videos on my website on this. So you're going to want to study up. But here's the procedure. You're going to want to pay your – first, get your child a debit card or bank account. At age 14, it's going to be easy to go into any bank and get a teen checking account. That's step one. Number two, either out of a family management sole proprietorship that you fund from an S-Corp, or you may pay them directly from your business if it's a sole proprietorship, or pay them from an LLC that holds your rental property. But you have to make it a business deduction and call it outside labor for janitorial support. Make sure they have a legitimate duty, a legitimate service. You're going to take a write-off in the business for this subcontractor, which is your son, and write the check or transfer the money online into his account and let him pay for soccer, school clothes, lunch, summer camp, the whole nine yards. So making your child an employee is – you don't have to withhold Sudafood, FICA, workers' comp. You don't have to 1099 him. And you open up a whole host of other strategies here to not only to teach – financial management and fiscal responsibility and entrepreneurship, but you could even fund. Matt, what can you do with that earned income for his son now?
Oh, Roth IRA. Bam,
woo!
Love that.
Yeah, that was like an alley-oop. I just threw the ball up there. And
I know.
Like, you know,
I know.
That
I
just
tried
came
to
out
like
of nowhere.
Slam it home, you know, and I was like taking it slow and easy. But I love this strategy. I love this strategy. I do it myself. It is cool. My kids are always like, oh, what's this money in my bank account, Dad? Like, no, don't spend that yet. Don't spend that yet. That's set aside for some stuff for you.
I love it. Okay, we got to move quick here. We've got just we got 10, 15 minutes left here, and we got a couple more questions. We try to keep this show to under an hour. I know there's podcasts that are – less or more than that on iTunes, but we're doing a full hour every week for you. Let's see if we have any live callers. I better check on that in the studio. No live callers at the moment. If you want to call in, it's 646-668-8326. Press the number 1, and Jennifer in the studio will bring you on the show. Back to a Facebook question. Then we'll go to emails. But Manu has the question of, management condo fees are increasing. What is necessary for an investment condo? What is necessary for investment condo owners to self-manage their condominium projects? Matt, can I give this a shot and then throw you the rocks here, and you can take it to the hoop again? All right.
Yeah.
Since it's kind of NBA playoffs, I'm trying to be cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a CPA, so it's a struggle. So I got to make all the analogies I can. Something sporty like NBA playoffs. Okay, so here's the thing. Everybody out there, if you invest in a condominium project, so you may buy a condo and then put it in a rental pool or sign a long-term tenant. And we have a lot of clients that buy condos and rent them. A lot of times the condo rental strategy works well in kind of vacation type areas. So that's great. So Manny's struggling here because when you buy a condo, your condo is part of an association for common area fees. They're setting aside money for the roof someday. There's sidewalks, there's landscaping, hallways, whatever. All those common areas are shared expenses amongst all the condo owners. Now, here's what's hard. Those condo associations can sometimes really jack up the fees, take care of them, some executive on the board of the condo association can be controlling and spendy, and it's going to affect your rates. Now, if you want a real-life example of this, or at least a television example of this, go watch an episode of Seinfeld when he goes to visit his family in Florida. There's usually some good condo drama. Now, here's the only way, Manu, that you can – there's no way you can manage your own condo. It's just – it's not a federally allowed process. You can, I mean, under all the laws that go with condos, and there's a nonprofit association that runs the condo, there's no way you can do it personally to kind of say, oh, I don't want to play. I'll just pay for it myself. It doesn't – there's no way to do that. But here's what you can do. I'm going to throw out two options. First, Manu, is get involved. Go show up at the condo association meetings. Find out when the next one is. Rally the support of other condo owners. This is where you got to play some politics, but it's not too hard to maybe find out who the other owners are near you, around you, when you're there visiting the condo, taking tax write-offs to go visit it. Mm-hmm. When you're there, go visit some of the other condo owners or renters and find out who the owners are and start to put together a little consortium to take over the condo association and say, you know what, we're all unhappy and we're going to vote you out unless you deal with it. Again, watch Seinfeld for a good, funny example of that. Last point, I've got a client out of California that loves buying condo rentals, but he only does it when he can buy. Now, he's a big buyer. He's a big buyer, so I'm just throwing this out. He'll go into an area where there's a number of the condos for sale. Now, this is when he was doing this more often, of course, the 2008, 9, 10 crash. He would go in and buy a bunch of the condos that were a lower value because of the real estate crash. So it's probably not as common now, but he would buy enough condos to get enough votes to take over the association. Then he would revamp the association expenses and fees, which would only increase the value of his condo further by driving down those costs. So anyway, if you're a big investor, you might be able to take down enough condos to get control of the association just by through ownership, or you can play politics and get everybody involved and try to revamp the leadership. Matt, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I'd just say talk to the president of Del Boca Vista down in Florida. I believe that's Morty Seinfeld. and get some tips from Morty.
I like it. Yeah,
no,
I've
been on condo boards myself. I had a rental property in a condominium complex, and I mean, it's tough. It's tricky. You got to deal with different personalities, and there are a lot of expenses in condos and shared costs you have to bear. So, you know, it's really tricky. I don't want you to feel totally powerless, but I don't want you to get any false sense of I'm going to be able to take over the world and fix things. But see what you can do to get involved. You can always have access to all the financial information and the contracts as a member of the condominium association. So you can at least check and make sure, is what's happening legit, or is there a lot of fluff and garbage in here? And that might give you an indication of whether it's worth investing your time and recruiting others to try and make a coup on the homeowners association or not.
Yeah, great comment. And we could talk about – we ought to have a show about condo investing and condo issues, because I own a condo rental as well, and it's kind of – the association got disbanded. It fell apart. There is no condo association, which is very odd. And so it's constantly trying to point the finger at the other condo owners to who's going to pay for what. And there's a roof issue, right? It's a mess. So condos have good things and bad things. So good topic for another day. Okay, Matt, we got another question here. This is Shirley. I'm going to throw it out here. And, oh, you know what? Before we do Shirley's question, let me do the question of the week. All right, it's about time, right? 10 minutes left in the show. Let's throw it down.
Let's get it.
So I've alluded to my book a couple times during the show, and some of you are probably thinking, I got to get Mark's book. This is critical. Mark's book will save me thousands. I know you're thinking that. So this is your chance to win the book. So here's the question of the week. First one to respond in an email to either Mark, M-A-R-K, at KKOS Lawyers, or Matt, M-A-T, at KKOS Lawyers. And I know there's many of you listening on your smartphone. In fact, I think it was Michael or Bruce that says he's jogging right now. Stop what you're doing, take a breather, and email in your answer on your smartphone. Here's the question. If I am an active real estate investor, which means I'm trying to deduct a good portion of my rental losses, if I want to check the box that I am an active real estate investor, is there a time requirement in order to qualify as an active investor and check that box that looks so inviting on TurboTax for some do-gooders on your own? If you want to check that box, is there an hour requirement of how many hours you have to be doing real estate a year? That's it. And so that's send in your answer. Shoot us an email. First one to respond wins a copy of either mine or Matt Sorensen's book. Okay, so next question. I'm going to throw this out. This is from Shirley. So, Matt, I'm going to throw it out to you here.
Okay.
We have an S-Corp that we've been running for the last 6 years, but have recently stopped doing business as a senior in-home care agency. We'd like to change the direction of the company and start doing real estate investing in general. We'd be investing in residential care facilities for the elderly, single-family homes, and family multifamily apartments. The SFRs and multifamily units wouldn't necessarily be for the elderly. Okay. Could we close our current S-Corp and open a new one, or could we just keep the current one that we have and make a note of that decision in the minutes? Not sure if it matters. According to the SIC and NAIC codes, are currently under the services of elderly codes, yada, yada. We'd also be changing the name of our company. Are there other considerations we should be asking or thinking about? Matt, your thoughts. Should they revamp this S-Corp and use it for their rentals?
Well, probably not, because let's think of the rentals. I mean, what income are you going to want to run through the S-Corp from your rentals? None. It's rental income. Why? I wouldn't want to necessarily – I wouldn't want to run that income through an S-Corporation. And the S-Corporation is great. We want to have that for ordinary income, fees for goods or services. But if all you're going to have is pure rental income, we generally just use an LLC for asset protection. Have that income run through the LLC. You're not going to pay Medicare or self-employment tax on it. Rental income is always exempt from it. And so I don't know that I'd even bring in the S-Corp into the equation if you're just going to have rental income left at the end of the day.
Yeah, I just want to echo your comments, Matt. In fact, surely I'll be more clear, too, and say that unless you're going to do fix and flips and rehabs or run some operational business, you're probably just going to dissolve the S-Corp. Let it go. It's gone. It's cool. I know you may have an emotional attachment to it. No, that's our little S-Corp. But you're changing the name anyway. So just let it leave the coop and fly away and kill that S-Corp and then set up a new LLC, clean and fresh, to hold these rental properties. We generally, in sum, do not want to see rentals in a S-Corp. We're going to be wanting to use an LLC. So I think you're going to toss it out with the bathwater. There you go, Shirley. Did I use enough analogies in that example, Matt? I was trying to throw it out.
Yeah, I think I like the Frozen reference. I loved it. But I don't have any other comments on that. I just think stick LLC. Don't worry about the S-Corp. Like we said, let it go. But dissolve it. Don't just let it go. Actively dissolve it. Get rid of it. Make sure you avoid state fees going forward and tax return reporting requirements. Really just shut it down properly. Let me say that.
Yep, I like it. Good comment, Matt. Okay, now, Matt, do you have a question you want to pose here? I've got one here. What do you got?
I'm out on my questions. We only got 2 minutes left, too, so I'm not You fire away if you got one burning one left that you like.
Oh yeah, this is easy, good stuff. So I've got one last question because when I said use an HSA, I threw that out earlier. I got to think. I think that was to lose our caller on that one, it was to Bruce or Michael. I'm sorry about that. No, it was Dolph. Dolph had the healthcare question. So Dolph asked, well, how much can I put into an HSA in 20 or what should I do for those extra expenses? Sorry, guys, I'm killing it.
Yeah.
But we just had a question. This is from Eric. He said, Mark, you mentioned an HSA earlier. How much can I put in an HSA this year in 2016?
Mm-hmm.
If you're single, you're looking at $3,350. If you're a family, $6,750. So it's a big contribution this year. You have a $1,000 makeup if you're over age 55. So folks, this is a deduction on the front page of your tax return. And we love this. And the HSA is so, so powerful. And Matt, do you want to comment on the HSA?
I was just gonna jump in and say you don't phase out on it. You know, it's cool. It's like Mark said, it's on the front page of your tax return, and you're getting the deduction as you put the money in, whether you spend it or not. You know, you put the money in, you're gonna get a deduction, and so it can build up in the health savings account over time, and you may use it later in life, or you have a year of significant medical expenses. But then, of course, when you do use the HSA, it comes out tax-free for any medical expenses, prescription drugs, dental, I mean, all that stuff, medical-related, you get to use and spend the money out of the HSA.
Yeah, and oh my gosh, we could just go on and on. We could turn this into a whole show about HSAs and how cool they are. There's some qualifications of just having a high-deductible plan, and you can even pull money out to reimburse yourself for medical expenses you had before you funded the HSA. As long as you get that account going, you can always put money in and turn around and then take it right back out to reimburse yourself. So the HSA is so powerful. Well, I just want to finish in our last minute here. This is a call to action, people. I know many people are listening to this today live and then tonight on iTunes as soon as it posts. Here's an important point. This Saturday, Matt Sorensen, yours truly, Mark Kohler, are going to be in Phoenix doing a full day on self-directed IRA strategies. And you don't have to come to Phoenix, even though it's a beautiful time of year. You can log in and watch us live with live streaming. Matt, what would you want to add here?
Yeah, it's Saturday. It's going to be a heck of a good time. Any of you who are self-directed your retirement account or have looked into doing it, it's going to be the most impactful day, important day of training, period, you'll ever have on the topic. Mark and I are both speaking as well as some other experts. You can go to sdirasummit.com, sdirasummit.com for the details. And we'd love to see you there in Phoenix. I've actually almost sold out the room, literally. I can't believe it. And we've had tons of interest in the virtual summit. We're having a professional company stream it and do the videoing, so it'll be top-notch production quality. And we're looking forward to it, actually. Mark and I are going to be together on stage. I always love being able to speak with Mark. We don't get to do it as much now as we used to, but it's going to be a heck of a good time.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Well, I want to say thanks to everybody listening for another week here on the show. Please spread the word on your social media, your friends, your family. We're here every Wednesday at noon Mountain, live. And next week, we've got a great topic, so please stay tuned. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.